Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today as Jim braves the crowds at CPAC. We'll get some pretty interesting stories from him on Monday, I have a feeling. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives as we wrap up the work week. And David, let's start with the good martini. This is courtesy of Reuters with a hat tip to Hot Air for pointing out this story. President Trump says he wants to expand the U.S. nuclear arsenal to ensure the country is, quote, top of the pack. This was in an interview with Reuters on Thursday, and here's what the Reuters piece says. Trump said in the interview he would like to see a world with no nuclear weapons, but expressed concern that the United States has, quote, fallen behind on nuclear weapon capacity. I am the first one that would like to see nobody have nukes, but we're never going to fall behind any country, even if it's a friendly country. We're never going to fall behind on nuclear power. It would be wonderful. A dream would be that no country would have nukes. But if countries are going to have nukes, we're going to be at the top of the pack, Trump said. Russia has 7,300 warheads and the United States 6,970, according to the Plowshares Fund, an anti-nuclear group. Back to Hot Air. At issue is the New START Treaty, which is scheduled to go into a full effect in 2018. New START limits the number of deployed nuclear arms Russia and the United States can have. Trump did not say whether he wanted to scrap New START, but did say it was a one-sided deal. And David, for a guy who didn't know what the nuclear triad was a little over a year ago, this is a pretty encouraging sign. The Obama administration obviously wanted to do nothing to upgrade and maintain the nuclear arsenal, making sure that our weapons actually worked, since we haven't produced many of them at all in the last many years here. So the fact that if we're going to have countries with nuclear weapons, the United States should be the one with the most imposing arsenal. Peace through strength still works.
Right. I mean, you know, the policy of the previous administration seemed to be disarmament through obsolescence and decay. I think people don't realize the extent to which our nuclear weapons arsenal is aging. I mean, it's very, very old. And so I think this is positive. I mean, we have demonstrated since World War II that the American nuclear arsenal is one of the guarantors of peace. It is one of the guarantors of the safety and security of our nation. And I'm waiting to hear the argument that we should allow Russia or China to be ahead of us in this category. Obviously, we shouldn't. It's not at all dangerous or scary that Trump wants to modernize the arsenal. It's not at all dangerous or scary for us to be the leading nuclear power. I mean, I think basic national interests of the United States is to be the leading military power in the world, and that includes the leading nuclear power.
This could get those really fun people with the nuclear clock ticking it closer to midnight, David. That'll be a nice photo op sometime soon, right?
Oh, that the doomsday clock yeah. is one of the funnier. It's funny how news media treats it as if there's this small group of like people with godlike powers on Mount Olympus who can divine how close the world is to the apocalypse, and are updating this clock. It's just a bunch of guys making guesses. I mean, really, why are we not doing a doomsday clock? I mean, why we should implement our own doomsday clock. It would be just as credible as theirs.
Don't let Twitter create a doomsday clock, because it'll be at 11:59 and 59 seconds.
Absolutely. And every new day, it would be 11:59 and 59 and 99, 99 to 100, 999, 1,000s. Oh, yeah. Twitter's – I love – can I criticize – is it fair to criticize Twitter by referencing a tweet?
Sure.
Okay. So I saw a great tweet the other day. It was like, if you're watching Instagram, the theme is look how fun I am. If you're watching Facebook, the theme is my life turned out really pretty great. If you're watching Snapchat, the theme is I'm kind of quirky and unusual and only want my close friends to see. And then if you're watching Twitter, the theme is we're all going to die.
On to the bad martini now, David, and this is just the latest example of why conservatives should not be upset that John Boehner is no longer in Congress and certainly no longer is Speaker of the House. This is courtesy of Politico. Former House Speaker John Boehner predicted on Thursday that a full repeal and replace of Obamacare is, quote, not what's going to happen, and that the Republicans will instead just make some fixes to the health care law. Boehner, who retired in 2015 amid unrest among conservatives, said at an Orlando healthcare conference that GOP lawmakers were too optimistic in their talk of quickly repealing and then replacing Obamacare. Quote, "They'll fix Obamacare, and I shouldn't have called it repeal and replace because that's not what's going to happen. They're basically going to fix the flaws and put a more conservative box around it," Boehner said. The former speaker's frank comments capture the conundrum that many Republicans find themselves in as they try to deliver on pledges to axe Obamacare but struggle to coalesce around an alternative. More Boehner, quote, "In the 25 years that I served in the United States Congress, Republicans never, ever, one time agreed on what a health care proposal should look like. Not once. And all this happy talk that went on in November and December and January about repeal, repeal, repeal. Yeah, we'll do replace, replace. I started laughing because if you pass repeal without replace first, anything that happens is your fault. You broke it." And David, the New York Times and other places are pointing out that there is some friction among the Republicans in both the House and Senate about whether to do repeal and replace simultaneously, how aggressive to be, how soon it should be. Can you get the moderates and the conservatives on board between the folks that have safe seats and toss-up seats and so forth? So there is some hand-wringing going on about this, but John Boehner's let's not even try approach is probably one of the good reasons he's not there anymore.
Well, right. I mean, you know, look, one of the things that's just hitting everyone in the face, and it's something that a lot of us knew from the beginning, is that once you put an entitlement program in place, it is extremely difficult to repeal it. It's one of the reasons why we, as a matter of fact, haven't repealed any entitlement programs, because once an entitlement program is there, you have lots and lots of beneficiaries. So even if the program sort of hurts the community at large, it's still going to benefit at least some defined group of people. And the people who do benefit from it, believe me, they know it, and they know that they benefit. And then they worry about what the future is going to look like in a repeal replace. So that's what Congress is dealing with. And that's why Republicans fought so hard against Obamacare to begin with, because they knew this dynamic would occur. Now, what I wish they hadn't done was sort of sit there and tell the conservative public that, oh, we're totally going to repeal, we're totally going to repeal, this is immediately what's going to happen, because you've created this expectation, not just that Obamacare will be obliterated, but that there will be something else, and that something else will be awesome. that's kind of easier said than done, because, you know, frankly, top to bottom, our healthcare system is a little bit of a complicated, tangled, expensive mess. So nothing, just as Obamacare was a mess, the idea that we can replace it with something neat, clean, that benefits pretty much everybody and hurts virtually nobody is a myth as well. So there's a lot of hard work to be done. A week or 10 days ago, I might have been more pessimistic. I'm getting a little bit more optimistic that there will be meaningful change, that there will be at least reform that's going to do away with the worst elements of Obamacare. But no one should be under any illusions. This is really, really hard. And at the root of it is this sort of contradictory, inconsistent position that people have about healthcare generally. And that contradictory, inconsistent position is that we should all have access to the best top quality healthcare available, every single living human being in the United States. At the same time, our healthcare should be delivered with all of the efficiency, energy, and innovation inherent in the free market. So those two goals are not necessarily complementary. If you're going to have energy, innovation, efficiency, all of those things, you're going to have the profit motive involved. You're going to have, you're going to have situations where you're going to need to be incentivizing people to make a lot of money in the healthcare industry. At the same time, that makes, when you're talking free market typically doesn't mean universal access. For example, you know, the free market in automobiles. Everyone has the right to buy an automobile. Well, I mean, everyone, you know, in the market system, in theory, has a right to buy an automobile, but not everybody can afford it. But we don't want to treat healthcare like that. So there's this internal philosophical problem that we have, where we want all of the benefits of the free market and all of the benefits of the universal access, and that's hard to pull off. I mean, it's really hard to pull off, and I think some of the congressional plans that I've seen are better than Obamacare, but none of them are going to deliver sort of a healthcare utopia that voters sometimes seem to demand.
Yeah, that's an interesting and very complicated mess, as you mentioned. Universal access, all the innovation, and cheaper. So
right. And a pony.
Yes, exactly. So hopefully Secretary Price, who has written a few repeal and replace bills during his time in Congress, can kind of lead the charge on this. He's an articulate spokesman and understands the issue as well as anyone. And with him working with his good friend Paul Ryan and others up on Capitol Hill, we'll see what they come up with. But the clock is ticking, and I spoke with the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus earlier in the week, and he said if it doesn't happen this year, it's probably not going to happen, in this Congress at least. So time's a ticking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the year to do it, because if you're going to do it next year, then that's an election year for these congressmen. And no congressman wants to face a constituency, especially those people who are in the more swing districts, where a defined large number of constituents and have felt like they have been concretely hurt by the action of this congressman. And it's more than just the people who feel like they've been hurt. It's their friends. It's their relatives. It's all the people that they communicate with on social media. So you take a defined group of people that feels like they've been wronged, multiply their voice, you know, by a factor of 10 or a factor of 100, and you've got a recipe for defeat. You've got a recipe for the kind of wave election that the Democrats suffered through in 2010. So the Republicans want to avoid that, so that's why they want something that they can pass that fixes the problems of Obamacare while preserving the most popular elements. And that's just hard. That is really hard to do, and I do think the conservative public needs to be a little bit patient. Let's not demand that it happen right away. It needs to happen this year, but this needs to be done carefully. This needs to be done deliberately, and it needs to be done thoughtfully. Otherwise, you'll end up with a Pyrrhic victory.
Let's move on to the crazy martini now, and David, it's a follow-up to yesterday's good martini, and we should tell folks out there that there's going to be some rather frank anatomical references in this martini, so if you have children in the car or at the table, you might want to pause this and come back to it a little bit later. Yesterday, our good martini was the Trump administration, through the Justice Department, rescinding the Obama administration directive that all public schools adopt comprehensive transgender accommodation policies. And David explained very well what that includes, not just bathrooms and showers, but also overnight trips and lots of other different things that students and faculty and anybody on the premises would encounter. This is going to shock you, David, but apparently Chris Cuomo over at CNN does not agree with the Trump administration policy. It's very interesting for liberals when they want the government to back away. They'll say the government has no business in this. When the government actually does back away and they don't want them to, it leaves this confusing patchwork of policies around the country that just leave everybody in confusion about what they can do in different places. So it's very interesting to watch that play out, depending on the issue and the argument. But Chris Cuomo got into a Twitter conversation with a number of different people. And you know what we've said about Twitter already in this podcast. So Chris Cuomo was suggesting that this was the wrong move by the Trump administration, and he wants to see data and evidence that when these policies are instituted, that there's a demonstrable rise in assaults and harassment and all sorts of other things by people sharing intimate facilities with different anatomy. And so as that argument went on, a person on Twitter with the handle Purported Pundit tweeted at Chris Cuomo, "What do you tell a 12-year-old girl who doesn't want to see a penis in the locker room?" His response, "I wonder if she is the problem or her overprotected and intolerant dad. Teach tolerance." Then another guy responds to that, known as Jason C. His handle's at Counter Moonbat. Interesting argument. If you don't want your 12-year-old daughter to see a penis in the locker room, you're overprotective and intolerant. Chris Cuomo's response, "My point was dead clear. This isn't about a scared girl. It's about an overprotective parent who is afraid without basis. Don't twist it." Eric Erickson over at The Resurgent says that Cuomo believes that a 12-year-old girl would not object to a naked boy in her locker room but for her parents. His presupposition is that his values are superior to the values of more than half of America, the majority of whom would object to a boy in the girl's bathroom. David, you and I are both the fathers of girls. I would have a problem with this. I think our wives would have a big problem with this. Forget the kids for a minute. I think adult women, for the most part, would have an issue with this. And I think most kids around 12 years old, teenage years, they would have problems being around people of their own sex in the locker room. Throw in the other mix, and it just gets bad in a hurry.
I have two daughters, and both of them would have a problem with this. I mean, it's absurd. You know, look, exposure to male genitalia used to be called indecent exposure. So if somebody walked into a women's locker room and undressed and exposed themselves, that's indecent exposure. If the school not only knew about it but explicitly permitted it, that would be the basis of an absolute backbreaking sexual harassment lawsuit. But now, indecent exposure, I guess, is just being yourself. I mean, it's tolerance. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. So here's how incoherent this is. I'm sure Chris Cuomo would say, well, no, a guy who is a member, say, of the middle school football team shouldn't walk into the girls' locker room and undress and expose himself. But then he would say that a quote-unquote trans girl who's anatomically identical to the guy that he would say shouldn't be in there not only can go in there, but he would say has a right to go in there and undress and expose himself. That makes no sense at all, none. And the thing is, the thing that's so discouraging about this is – okay, I'm going to make a declarative statement here. The declarative statement is that no 12-year-old girl should be exposed to the sight of male genitalia against her will. If we can't agree on that as a moral statement, I don't know if we're even speaking the same moral language anymore. Mm. If you cannot sit there and agree with that statement that at school – a 12-year-old girl should not be exposed against her will to the sight of male genitals. Where are we in even being able to have discourse on this? But that's how fanatical the other side has become on this notion that there's really no such thing that biological sex is essentially irrelevant to identity. So, you know, you're a bigot if you say a woman can't have a penis or a man can't get pregnant. That's just pure bigotry, because everyone knows that sex is just this basically irrelevant thing compared to the thoughts in your head about what you want to be. And if you can't sort of sit there and say anymore, wait, can we at least have a discussion about that? Can we at least debate that? Can we at least leave this to individual school boards who know the kids and the parents involved to try to figure out the best accommodation? If we can't even have that conversation anymore, we can't even talk to each other.
And what do you make of Cuomo being this direct, this blatant? Obviously, this is on Twitter. It's not directly on CNN, but he's a public figure. And I would imagine that most people in his position at the major media outlets would hold the same one.
I'm glad he's this open, to be honest. I mean, what I don't like is when people who are biased pretend they're not. I would much rather know what somebody believes and rather than go through this charade of saying, oh, well, you're this completely unbiased person, and then just try to understand the bias by watching how they choose to cover stories and sort of like reading tea leaves instead of reading tweets. You know, there's very few journalists who truly, at the end of the day, I don't know their politics, and I don't know their politics either because they keep them to themselves or because they are so unbiased and play it so straight and hold both sides to the fire equally. You know, one of the few journalists that comes to my mind who really fits that bill is Jake Tapper. So, you know, if you come into Jake Tapper's house and you're dishonest, whether you're Democrat or Republican doesn't matter. Jake Tapper is going to handle you. But if you're there's very few journalists really anymore that fit that bill. And I, you know, truth be told, I'd really rather know where they stand. So I don't have a problem with him tweeting. What I have a problem with is his point of view.
David, we've covered a lot of ground the past couple of days. Always great to have you filling in for Jim. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I know your listeners will be relieved to get Jim back.
Real quick, you do such a great job on this podcast when we have you on. I know you've got a new podcast coming up soon. Go ahead and give it a plug.
Yes, yes. A new podcast coming. It's called The Liberty Files. It should be coming next week. Watch my Twitter feed. Watch National Review for the announcement. And what we're going to do is we're going to tell stories of people. We're going to make the case for individual liberty by telling stories. And we're going to talk about real lives of real people who have been impacted by government censorship, by government oppression, even here in the United States. And some of the stories will, frankly, they'll blow your mind. So please tune in and watch my Twitter handle, at David A. French. Go to National Review for updates, but should be coming next week. Don't hold me to it, but it'll either be this next week or the week after.
The Liberty Files. Look for it, as you mentioned, at David A. French on Twitter and nationalreview.com. David, again, have a great weekend. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
David French of National Review. And for Jim Garrity, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and tune in Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.